We have been in this book of Esther 2 weeks now, and last time we covered the story in chapter 1 of King Xerxes' rejection of his wife, his kind of banishing of her from his presence, after her refusal to come and display her beauty before his feast. And today we come to chapter 2. It's important to keep in mind that chapter 2 is a continuation of the introduction to the book of Esther. And as we're looking at chapter 1 and comparing it to chapter 2, these two really do work together, and in a sense they're kind of a mirror image of each other, except that the main turn goes in the opposite direction here. In chapter 1, you have this trajectory. You have the queen deposed at a feast. And what do you have in chapter 2? It is the opposite trajectory of Esther being enthroned as a queen. In the very last part of our passage, which is verse 18, you're going to read about a feast as well, where they are celebrating their new queen. And so the stories go together, they answer to each other. One is kind of a problem, the other one is kind of the solution. And yet, on another level, the stories are actually on the same tracks. They're actually parallel. And here's what I mean by that. That in both of them, it looks like a powerful ruler is throwing his weight around and he is getting his own way. And yet ultimately, particularly as you read the rest of the book, really what is happening in both cases is that a woman is asserting herself, and through that she is exposing that this powerful ruler really isn't as in charge as it first appeared. You want to keep those thoughts together as we go through the story. As we think about what's happening here and how this all unfolds, there are two minor characters, several minor characters we want to be familiar with. We read about Xerxes' advisors who have this idea for how he can find himself in life. We have Mordecai. We have Haggai, who is the eunuch in charge of the king's harem. And they play a role, but really they are supporting roles to the main human characters of this story, which would be Xerxes and Esther. And the action centers on the choices of those two characters and the outcomes of the choices that Xerxes and Esther make. And yet, this is only an introduction. It's really impossible to have the right perspective of these characters and their stories and their choices and their outcomes apart from reading on to the end. So thankfully, we know what happens at this point. And we understand where the narrator is going with this. Those are, humanly speaking, the main characters, but in line of the plot of the whole book, what we know is this, that God is the offstage director, we might call it. He is the offstage director who is overseeing all of those events, and he is moving them forward to accomplish what he intends to do through Esther. And as I think about Xerxes and Esther, as I think about their choices, their character, what's revealed about them in this chapter, as I think about the interrelationship between their choices, what they intend, and what God intends, the dynamic between the human side and the divine side, what comes to mind is a saying that I heard long ago, maybe you've heard it as well, God can draw a straight line with a crooked stick. God can draw a straight line with a crooked stick. I do believe that that is a fair way to capture the drift overall of this chapter, particularly as it relates to the rest of the book. And as we get into that, I would like to walk us through the structure of this book, and particularly chapter 2. And I think Lance is going to have to take over as well. As you see up there, the general title is that statement, straight lines with crooked sticks. And one of the first things we need to do as we dig into the story and try to appreciate these characters is just understand the basic structure or the outline and the flow of chapter 2. And today we're actually going to just take it through verse 18, which kind of ends the main events, the main action in this chapter. And what I'd like to do is just follow this outline and read for us here at the outset these verses. In verses 1 to 4, we have the idea for a plan that Xerxes can follow to find himself a queen. Verses 1 to 4. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. And so there you have the inciting action that gets the chapter rolling. But how is it going to be resolved? How is this process going to unfold? And who's going to end up being chosen as the queen? Right away, it's as though the author stops telling the story, and he is going to talk next about this woman, Esther, being one of those virgins who participates in this kind of beauty contest. But he stops and he sort of shifts gears by introducing us to her, giving some background to her. Starting at verse 5. "Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter." And after that bit of background, now we are going to read how she ties into the story. Verse 8. "So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her." And so she is now involved in this process. And she is waiting to see what will happen to her and who's going to be chosen. And in the rest of this passage, verses 12 to 18, you find that she is the one chosen. But again, you begin with the word background and kind of some explanation to lead up to the actual event. So look at verse 12 for that. "Now when the turn came for each woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem in custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by Naaman. And so how's Esther going to fare in that seedy process? Verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except for what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her, and when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the author of Esther is a master storyteller. We know the story, so we know what's going to happen, but you notice the really long sentences he's using, and it kind of stretches out these descriptions that may not be technically necessary. And so here at the point where the matter is finally resolved, he sort of goes on and on about what exact month it is and what year and so forth. Well, finally, verse 17. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces, tax-free weekend, and gave gifts with royal generosity to celebrate his marriage to Esther. Well, that's a pretty unusual story. Some of it not the sort of thing that you're used to reading in the Bible. Raises a lot of questions, and as I say, ultimately makes the point that God draws straight lines with crooked sticks. Or another way to make the point, to state the theme, is simply as follows. God's providence works in and through human sinning. In other words, our failures, serious as they might be, are not ultimately going to be able to stop what the Lord intends to do. He is displeased with our sin. There are often painful consequences to our sin. There is no excuse for our disobedience. None of that is able to thwart, though, his purposes. And in fact, to the point of this passage, our sin can even be used as an instrument in his all-wise hands to accomplish a good and glorious and redemptive purpose. That's what we see throughout Esther, but we see it, I think, especially in this chapter. God's providence works in and through human sin. Now, what we're going to do is look at those two main human characters and just be very honest about their failures or the questions that we have about their actions in this passage. And take note of how, despite however bad it might have been, this was all still being perfectly symphonized by God to carry out his plan ultimately to protect his people from destruction. So we're going to start thinking about the first crooked stick, and we're talking about the emperor. Ahasuerus is the book given, is the name given in the Hebrew Bible. Xerxes is his name known from Greek writings. He was a crooked stick in many ways, and here's the point I'd like to make from his character. That is that providence works in and through moral abandoned. Abandoned, I mean somebody who's just totally reckless. Somebody who has no framework of the worldview that the Hebrew Bible was teaching the people of God. Who had no interest in that, who had no background in that, who had no qualms about doing anything he wanted to do given the power he had, whether it was in terms of politics or in terms of relationships with women or his treatment of others in general, this man was just totally out there. Moral abandon, reckless, licentious, out of control in his behavior. And yet the Lord steps into that seedy situation and turns it around in ways that Xerxes could have no idea that God was up to. I think it's helpful to appreciate a little bit of other things we know about Xerxes and the historical background that lay behind these events and that probably the original readers would have known already. I mentioned last week that this incident in chapter 1, it says in chapter 1, verse 3, that he had that feast and he deposed Vashti in the third year of his reign, which was 483. And then in what we read today, in verses 16 and 17, Esther becomes the queen in his seventh year. So that is 479 BC. And so you got 4 years in between those two events, and it's interesting to ask, what was going on during those intervening years? And what's going on is what I had mentioned last time that seems to have been the reason that Xerxes gathered together all of those people for the feast in chapter 1. This seems to have been a war council meeting slash rally slash celebration to gather together the people and make plans and inspire them and really win them over to the cause so that they would join him with all their energy and all their resources in attacking the Greeks. And what happened in the intervening years between chapter 1 and when Esther becomes the queen in chapter 2 is the war. And it's a war, as I mentioned last time, that he miserably failed in. He came back with his tail between his legs, his ambitions crushed, his father had failed that effort, he failed as well, and now he is left to himself, having lost all hopes of reaching the goal of basically conquering the world. So now what's going to happen? What is he going to do with the time he has remaining on earth? After he has depleted so much of the wealth of Persia in that failed effort, what is this man going to do? Well, he's going to go into even more financial trouble and strap his people down with the burden of building massive structures for the glory of himself, to kind of make up for his failures, I suppose. And there are some pretty impressive structures that you could go online and just search for Xerxes building efforts, and you'll see what he was doing, particularly after the war was over. And another thing we know about this man is that when he came back, he continued and seemed to be even more pursuing a life of unbridled sexual pleasure. This man was a profligate. He would have already had multiple women in the harem that's mentioned here. And there's a lot of material that fills in the gaps. Let me share with you one story by Herodotus. He tells us that at a certain point, Xerxes sort of fell in love with his brother's wife, and he tried to woo her to himself, commit adultery. But she refused him, and he was still intent on figuring something out. So what he did was to arrange a marriage between his son and her daughter. So this would be his niece. And they come over as a couple now to live as a part of the royal court. And in time, Xerxes falls in love with his niece and now daughter-in-law, and is able to convince her to commit adultery with him. And these things can't be kept secret, so his wife, Amestris, finds out. And in a pretty conniving way, she turns not against the niece, but she traces back to the other woman, the brother's wife, and arranges for that woman to just be gruesomely mutilated and sent back home. It's really a disastrous experience that she underwent, really no fault of her own, that woman. She had resisted the efforts, and yet she represented all that Amestris hated about what Xerxes was doing, and she cut off multiple of her body parts and sent her home. Amestris, who may very well have been the same woman, Vashti, as I mentioned last time, that was another way in which she gained the upper hand and asserted herself against Xerxes. And all of that is to say that the immorality and the intrigue that we read about in the book of Esther are consistent with the corruption that we know about this man recorded in other historical works. In fact, ultimately, in response to his decadence, after he got drunk at another party, he was eventually assassinated in his bedroom by one of his bodyguards. That would have been about 14 years later, in 465 BC. That's the sort of person we're reading about as you read the story of Ahasuerus. And how is it that this chapter depicts his character? I want to point out a few things as we go back to the beginning of chapter 2. To me, I find it comical, like there was a lot of comedy in chapter 1, a lot of satire, that after this war failure, it's like he turns his mind to what happened with Vashti, and he's just throwing up his hand saying, "Oh no, what have I done? I put away my wife. She embarrassed me, so I embarrassed her, and it would embarrass me again if I went back on my word. I mean, our law stands, nothing can be repealed. I've lost this woman. What am I going to do?" And here's this man who supposedly so powerful is just kind of helpless before the consequences of his own dumb choices and regretting having sent her away. And yet when you ask yourself, well, surely he can figure out some kind of solution, just like happened in chapter 1, he doesn't come up with a solution. What happens is that his advisors come to his side and they make a proposal. And for the second time now, you find that Xerxes, even though he is a main human character, is a responder. He is not proactively coming up with these ideas and making plans. He is getting all of his direction from other people and going along with what they had suggested. That's how this whole process for getting a queen started. And you have to wonder, what was the motive of those advisors in the plan that they suggested? Maybe some of them were the same advisors as had been involved in chapter 1. And as he starts to regret what he had done with Vashti, they might have been afraid that he was going to turn on them since it was their idea to start with. And so, fearing repercussions, they come up with another plan to solve the problem. Maybe it wasn't that. Maybe they were actually hoping that one of their own daughters would get chosen as the queen, in which case they would have a greater opportunity for influence and for position in the empire. This is the kind of stuff that happens in these ancient royal courts and maybe also in modern political affairs. Whatever their motive was, clearly their appeal was to the lust of Xerxes. They knew this man. They knew what made him tick. They knew him well enough that he would go for this beauty contest idea, even though it was a pretty unconventional way for an emperor to find a wife. Typically, the way it worked is that a king would choose a wife from the closest circles to the court, the elite of the empire, and these tended to be political arrangements. In other words, there was some kind of a political advantage for choosing this person from that family, for this connection, for this purpose. That was the normal way that these men went about choosing their wives. And yet he went this other pretty strange way. It was an appeal to his lust with this approach. Xerxes could try out or experiment with however, who knows, however many young women in the process of finally landing on one. These men knew what they were doing as they come up with this idea. And the whole thing has these undertones of sensuality. Maybe you were struck or confused by what it says in verse 12 about the process that these women went through before they had their one night with the king. And it talks about 12 months under the regulations, so this is a very stipulated, rigid thing of preparation, 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and ointments for women. What is that talking about? Archaeologists have found, for example, what are known as spice burners, where there would be a sort of receptacle for different kinds of oil, maybe oil of roses or oil of cloves that would burn slowly in these devices. And the thinking is that the women would stand over those things and just allow these smells to wash over them for apparently hours on end until it just thoroughly soaked into them and was just kind of woven into the whole atmosphere as they walked by. Or it could have been that they spent a long time soaking in baths that were also filled with perfumes, or even coloring agents that were designed to cover any possible blemish that might have been on their body that would have been not liked by the king. And that process of preparation went on for a whole year before any woman had her opportunity with the king. You thought that your wife took forever putting her makeup on. Incredible, the ingenuity. You know, how creative people get in order to make things as sensually pleasing as possible. And the whole court is just focused on the pleasure of this one man. Somebody's exposition that I read was entitled Beauty and the Beast. Not a bad way to describe what you read about when you think about Xerxes. And what is fascinating as well is a subtle way in which the text of the book is presenting Xerxes' approach to life. How self-oriented it was, how superficial it was. Maybe you pick up a number of times in this passage where it talks about such and such pleased him, or it was pleasing to him. Literally, those expressions are translating a phrase, good in his eyes. And I want to point those out to you. Actually, the first one is back in chapter 1. This shows up a number of times in Esther. Let's just dip in quickly. Look at chapter 1, verse 21, when the advice was given about what to do with Vashti. This advice, quote, was good in the eyes of the king. It pleased him. Look at chapter 2 and verse 4. Let the young woman who is good in the eyes of the king. And when he heard the plan was good in the eyes of the king as well. A little bit later in chapter 2 and verse 9. The young woman, this is talking about Esther and Haggai, was good in his eyes. Chapter 2 and verse 15. When Esther's turn came to go into the king, and it talks about what she did with following Haggai's advice, it says, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And there's a parallel expression. Chapter 3 and verse 6, when it's talking now about Haman, a member of Xerxes' court, it says, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. In other words, literally, this was despised in the eyes of Haman. It's talking about his outlook and whether he was pleased with what he saw there. As well in chapter 3 and verse 11, as the king is talking to Haman, do with the Jewish people now as it seems good to you, as it is good in your eyes. Chapter 5 and verse 2, we find a similar expression where Esther is preparing a banquet to resolve the crisis that her people are in. She won favor in his eyes. Chapter 5 and verse 8. If I have found favor in the eyes of the king, is what that says. Chapter 7 and verse 3. If I have found favor in your eyes, O king. Chapter 8, verse 5. If it please, or if it is good in the eyes of the king, and I have found favor in his sight. And then chapter 8 and verse 8 as well. You may write as it is good in your eyes with regard to the Jews. That's a strikingly consistent pattern as it relates to Xerxes and the people that are around him and how things operate in making decisions. Is it good in my eyes? Does it bring me pleasure? Do I find this to be attractive? Is it delightful before my eyes? It's a way that the author is indicating basically the philosophy of life that Xerxes follows. It's all about himself and what he sees visually and what appeals to him right away. If it feels good, do it. If it looks good to you, go for it. Do whatever you find pleasurable. There are no restrictions. You get to determine. The only rule is, do you like it? Do you find it attractive? That's what drove him. Sounds kind of familiar, because the first sin recorded in the Bible back in Genesis, when Satan was presenting to Eve the temptation, what was it all about? When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and desire to make one wise, she took the fruit and ate it. The lust of the eyes, the appeal to that which is visually enjoyable, that which is attractive, has been one of the main drives behind human sin from the beginning, and it's the main issue in how Xerxes makes his decisions. That hedonism was the nature of the rulers that God's people lived under. And yet, although this man lived that way, and that's how he made his choices, through it all, he unwittingly gets connected with a woman who's going to have a unique opportunity to serve the protective and the redemptive plan of God. Here's what's happening on a human level. He is pursuing his lust with all his might. And he is exerting all the power of the empire to get whatever he wants. But on the ultimate level, this man is a pawn who is being put in place in order to accomplish the will of a higher power. And in talking about the Lord using his sin that way, we're not excusing Xerxes. We're not saying that God was the one responsible for his sin. As we consider that kind of question, we have a verse like James 1:13 that is our theological guardrail of what does it say? Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. So the Lord is not culpable for what happened, and yet, in sovereign, the outcome, what he has, able to use the himself and to be a part of getting the victory over that enemy. That's what's happening here. Do the shenanigans of that Persian court sound a little familiar? Political maneuvering. Self-serving decisions and policies. Immorality at the highest levels of authority. the abuse of power for personal pleasure. In our day, it might be more subtle, and it might be hidden for a longer time, but then some story breaks, and the newspaper headlines start to sound like Esther chapter 2. And once again, we are dismayed by how untrustworthy our governmental leaders are, even those we may have helped to put into power in the first place. How are we to think about all of this? And that no human being is capable of leading us perfectly or being the ultimate example. But ultimately, it should also reinforce what this book is designed to teach. That our God not only overcomes human sin in order to accomplish his purposes. It's not just that he has all these problems and he somehow got to get over them or get them out of the way and keep moving forward. It's not just that he overcomes human sin. He actually uses human sin to bring glory to himself. And as it relates to our nation, at any point, things might end up getting worse before they get better in the plan of God. But one way or another, God's kingdom is going to triumph, and he is going to synthesize even the most wicked rulers and their choices in order to carry out his plan. And that is where we rest our hopes. Providence works in and through moral abandon. At the same time, we cannot act as if believers are always paragons of virtue. And if we just got a Christian in positions of power, everything would turn out great. We cannot act as though even believers share no blame for the corruption of society. And we have some serious questions to ask as we consider that side of things in the character of Esther and the dubious choices that sometimes even God's people make. What I want to say about Esther is this. Number two, providence works in and through moral ambiguity. I didn't say moral abandon. I'm trying to walk a nice edge here, to stick with what the author of this book says and not go beyond. And yet what he says, all it does is to raise questions. And ambiguity means it's questionable. You can't really figure it out conclusively. But it sure makes you wonder, what in the world was she thinking? That's really what you're supposed to walk away with. The narrator studiously avoids making any explicit comment that makes a moral assessment of the actions of Mordecai and Esther. As you read the whole thing, you do find your heart going out with some sympathy for the difficult position that these Jewish people found themselves in. And yet, as you look closely at their actions and at some of the wording of the passage, and also what the rest of the Bible teaches, the best possible interpretation you can put on it is that it's questionable, is that it is ambiguous. And I want to show you that. First of all, we know that they were in Persia to begin with as a result of human sin. This was not their homeland. They were not in that place by any fault of their own. They lived in Persia because of the sins of their ancestors many generations ago. And verses 5 to 6 shout that at you when it first introduces this pair. Remember what it said about Mordecai? It gives some of his ancestors, and it mentions his great-grandfather Kish. We'll talk about that later in another message. But as it relates to Kish, it seems like it's talking about him in verse 6, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away 3 times. A word for deportation or exile is used here. And this is when you first encounter these people. That's how they are introduced. Somebody forced them into that position. They were in exile. This was not their home. And there were certain elements of this that we would have to say, that's just humanly speaking, this is a rough card that somebody's dealt with. You can blame that, humanly speaking, on your ancestors. There's an element of that here. And yet, I don't think that totally solves it. Because already, by the time the story happens, there had already been a major return of Jewish people who had been sanctioned by and even funded by an earlier emperor by the name of Cyrus. And they went over there and they rebuilt the temple, and they had a lot of problems of their own, but at least they were in Palestine. And many of them were trying to serve God and be faithful to the scriptures. And we don't know why so many of the people stayed in a position of exile. It seems to be actually the majority of them that stayed. Several tens of thousands of Jews returned, but probably the majority that we know of, but probably the majority stayed. And you just have to ask the question, why? When you had so many opportunities and a wide open door to make a fresh start in a new environment where you were allowed to worship the way that your scriptures teach, why did you not go back? That's at least a question worth asking. And then the moral dimensions of this, specifically the sexual arena. Jewish people would have known, it's a pretty obvious and loud and repeated emphasis that God hates fornication, that he's opposed to adultery. These things would have been taught to Esther from her childhood. And yet she complies, not just in a sort of an impulsive sort of getting carried away in a moment of emotion with somebody that she loved, but she complies with a year-long process of getting ready for a night of fornication and adultery. And somebody says, well, what choice did she have? This was the king. Maybe she was forced into it. Well, the earlier chapter, Vashti stood up to the king. And there were consequences, to be sure, but she still stood up to him. And she resisted. And even more important than that, consider the very strong precedent of believing people that the scriptures of the Hebrews told them about when they were almost contemporary to Esther. You think about somebody as far back as Joseph in the book of Genesis, who is in Potiphar's house and he is being repeatedly tempted by the wife of that man. And he says, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And he resists her to the point that she falsely accuses him and he ends up in jail for it. And that was a well-known story of what somebody in a pagan environment, feeling all this pressure from morality, how he responded. And even how God used him as a result of ending up in jail. Closer to home, not extremely long before this woman would have lived, in one of those invasions and exiles to Babylon before the Persians came along, you got Daniel. You got his three friends who are feeling pressure not about fornication, but about eating some food and drinking some wine. And frankly, it's debatable among scholars what they were so concerned about, because it could be argued that the law did not actually prohibit that in so many words. They were making an application of the biblical principle at that point. And they said, we're not going to violate our convictions here. And they find a way to work with the authorities to figure out a path forward. And God blesses them for having done the right thing and being above reproach. And this was Daniel, who was in the same situation in a pagan court in the previous administration. Add to that the fact that this is not just immoral, but that this woman ended up marrying an idol-worshipping Gentile, a pagan man, which was also forbidden by the law. In fact, one way to explain the whole history of Israel and her apostasy and her fall is to say that it is rooted in the problem of intermarriage with unbelieving people. That's how you explain the book of Judges. That's how you explain the entrance of idolatry into the nation as a whole. And that's how you explain the fall of Solomon. All the way through, the huge issue is, are God's people going to marry unbelieving people? And because of the compromise and the corruption that takes place through those kinds of intermarriages, that's why they ended up in exile. And you come toward the end of the Old Testament period, not too long, like a few decades after Esther, and you're reading about Ezra and Nehemiah. And what's the big problem with those stories? Ezra gets back. You read chapter 9 sometime. It won't take time to do this now. You read chapter 9. And here he is teaching the law of God and trying to do all this work to reform the practices of the people. He finds out there's just scads of these people, even in leadership, who married these local pagan women. And there's this huge, long, contrite prayer of confession in chapter 9 where he's just torn up. Oh, God, this is why we ended up in exile in the first place. And now we're doing it again. How can this be? Have mercy on us. And the book ends with a mass divorce, if you can believe this. Ezra, the leader, led all those people to divorce their wives. And all of their names are listed at the end of Ezra in chapter 10 because the problems created by those kinds of intermarriage were more severe than even the problem of divorce. And so that's what he chose to do. And Nehemiah, a generation later, has to go through the same sort of situation. So, in light of all that, you see this woman getting into this marriage with this man. Pretty dubious. And then you have the fact that a couple of times the text says that Mordecai told her, don't tell them you're a Jew. Chapter 2, verse 10, chapter 2, verse 20. Keep your identity hidden. Why did he say that? Not entirely sure. Again, it's ambiguous. But one possibility is that he actually wanted her to be chosen as queen. And he surmised that if they knew she was a Jew, she would be disqualified. She would not be one of the top picks. Now, I want to point out a couple of other things here, briefly. You remember that revelation of Xerxes' character in that phrase, good in his eyes? There is some wording about Esther's approach that suggests a concern as well. Look with me here in chapter 2 and verse 9. It says, the young woman pleased him and, quote, won his favor. In verse 15, as she's dealing with Haggai in preparation for her night, it says, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. The same thing in chapter 2, verse 17. The king now loves her, and she won grace and favor in his sight. And if you jump ahead to chapter 5 and verse 2, once again it says the Queen Esther won favor in his sight. Nowhere else, we're maybe used to reading phrases in the Old Testament that say such and such found favor in the eyes of so-and-so. But it is only in Esther and only in those passages in all the Old Testament that it says she won favor. It's a unique way of putting it. And in fact, this verb translated won, it means to pick up or carry. You could translate it that way. She carried off favor. It's not that she was passive and just kind of doing her own thing, and she found it. It was sort of thrown in her lap. This is a more active onset, I'm almost tempted to say she curried favor. We speak that in English. In other words, she knew what buttons to push. And a lot of the buttons had to do with her very compliant and going along spirit with this. And in that verse 15, it talks about how when it came to her night, she didn't have her own request. She defers to the leader of the harem, Haggai, and says, I will take in whatever you want. And she's just presented as a very compliant person. And perhaps as an actual strategy on her part to curry favor with the authorities. Well, all of that put together may well indicate that Esther was doing the very thing that I warned us not to do last week from chapter 1. The one application was what? That giving God sovereignty, even in these crazy circumstances coming at us from the world, don't accommodate. But it appears that actually Esther was inappropriately accommodating to her pagan culture at the expense of biblical morality. And some scholars see that idea implied even in the fact of her names that are given to her. And the fact that she is the only character in the book for whom two names are mentioned. And we know from Daniel that these men had their Jewish name and then a name given to them by the Babylonians. Something like that seems to be going on here. It says in verse 7 that her Jewish name is Hadassah, which is a word that means myrtle, as in the kind of tree. And as I thought about that, I discovered that in these post-exilic books, this idea of a myrtle shows up in some pretty important places, particularly Zechariah chapter 1. If you remember the vision that he saw, it was the angel of the Lord among the myrtles. And it seems to be an image of the people of Israel that are viewed with tenderness by the Lord. They're kind of small like myrtles are, not very strong, but he's present right there in the middle to protect them. And later on in Nehemiah chapter 8, when they celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, one of the kinds of branches that they used to make their little huts was specifically the myrtle tree. In other words, there's a connotation about Israel and her dependence on the Lord in that name. And I don't want to read too much into that, but I'm saying it's interesting that in those books of the same general period, this idea of a myrtle comes up as an image for Israel and God's devotion to her. But what about the name Esther? That is her Persian name, which could be the Persian word for star, or it could be a reflection of the Babylonian name Ishtar, which perhaps you've heard, and that is their goddess of love and war, in which case it's an even stronger connotation of paganism. It's kind of interesting. That's how that all works out in connection with everything else that we've seen. Leland Ryken, who's a great biblical literary scholar, says this about her. And about her name is that it gives the impression that this woman is living in two worlds at the same time. And she is struggling with two identities. She knows she belongs to the people of God, but she's gotten sucked into this godless culture, and at the outset, she's acting like a Persian in this chapter. But eventually, the Lord gives her the opportunity to side with her own people and make the choice to come out at the most critical moment and show her faith in the true and living God. And you see a kind of a transformation that by the grace of God takes place in the story, in the life of Esther that way. And it reflects the struggle that the Jewish people in exile generally would have had in those circumstances, and how they often failed to live as the people of God. Now, I agree with a lot of those assessments about Esther, but just to be on the safe side, all I said ultimately was God's providence works in and through moral ambiguity. And yet, however you phrase it, the point isn't to to criticize Esther or to make judgments on her. That's not really the point. It's God's providence works in and through moral ambiguity. It's about God. It's not about Esther. It's to emphasize that whatever is going on in her behavior, God remains sovereign whether we categorize her as morally questionable or actively immoral. He used her actions to put her exactly where she needed to be to accomplish one day a mighty deliverance. And again, none of that implies that God is implicated or that the end justifies the means. What it means is that God is so powerful that without implicating himself in our sin, he can still direct our sin to work out our salvation. I read this verse in Proverbs in my devotions this week, chapter 19, verse 21. Many are the plans in the mind of a man, and many of those plans are self-serving and wicked. Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of Yahweh that will stand. That's what we're seeing here. And really, it shouldn't trouble us that that's how God is working, because isn't that how the cross, our salvation, happened as well? What does it say in Acts chapter 2, verse 23? That this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God used sin in order to accomplish victory over sin and the forgiveness of our sin. That's just amazing. And so the Lord can draw straight lines with crooked sticks. His providence works in and through human sin. How would we apply that? What message for us can we take away? I'll give you a couple points here as we close. I'd say, first of all, what hope this gives us. When we sin, and also what hopes this gives us when somebody sins against us. If we're talking about our sin, we can easily live lives of regret and discouragement and despair and feel like there's no hope for us and we've totally blown having any kind of usefulness in the plan of God. Look at the kinds of people the Lord used in this story. And then as you think about people sinning against us, and I don't doubt that we could say Xerxes sinned against Esther. And she found herself on the wrong end of the powers of the day, a very challenging position. None of that has dethroned God. What people's sins against us give him an opportunity to do is to take up yet another tool to work out his plan of redemption and to bring about the full establishment of his kingdom on earth. That is the hope-filled message of Esther. I want to end with a story that an author gives to try to illustrate this. He talks about one night in the middle of a storm in an English pub. There was a big storm outside, so there was a bunch of people packed into this room. And it was difficult to serve everybody. People were bumping into each other all over the place and carrying on and having a great time. At one point, a waitress came through the crowd with a tray holding it high with cups of ale, coffee, and tea. As she was making her way through the pub, someone accidentally jostled her, and all those drinks went flying and splashed all over a recently painted wall. So how would you feel if these nicely recently painted walls, you know, we had some event in here, all this stuff ended up staining these walls? The proprietor was very angry. The whole crowd fell silent as they waited to see what he would do. The waitress stood frozen, and suddenly, from the corner of the pub, a man spoke out saying, "If you'll permit me, perhaps I can do something about them." The story goes on that he approaches the wall, he pulls out a little case filled with brushes and paints, as though he were an artist, and he started painting over that wall. And for about 45 minutes, this went on, and everybody everybody is intently focused on his work. He began to sketch with his charcoal and then with his paint. They watched as he went about his work, and there before them eventually shone this beautiful painting. The stains had been turned into something that was absolutely breathtaking. And when he was done, he stepped back, and it was almost as if everyone in the pub gasped together at the beauty of what was now before him. He took up his instruments, packed them up, quietly left into the store. People leaned in to look at the name he had signed at the bottom, and they discovered that they had actually been watching one of England's greatest artists at work. And they had seen him take something that was ugly and turn it into something that was beautiful. And this is the application that is drawn. You see it on the slide. Such is the powerful and sovereign grace of God. Whatever compromises you have made, whatever failures you have had, the truth of the matter is that God is subtly at work even in the midst of them. His providence is stronger than your compromises. His grace is greater than your failures. Like the artist in the pub, he is a God who takes the very blemishes and blotches of our lives and uses them, redeems them, and transforms them by his grace into something beautiful. And we've been kind of hard on Esther today. We've been kind of hard on Xerxes today. But folks, the reality is crooked sticks are the only kind of sticks God has. There aren't any straight sticks. We've all got our issues. We all have our skeletons in the closet. We all have our failures and our regrets. And this story is just shouting at us what this quote says. His providence is stronger than your compromises. His grace is greater than your failures. Let's take heart. May our hearts be filled with hope that we behold that this is our God and this is how sovereign he is.